Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anwa Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Michael Elliott. For many of you in the nuclear community, you know Mike. He's the former Deputy Director for Strategic Stability on the Joint Staff. He was at Deputy J5 at STRATCOM. You know, he's a retired Air Force officer. He flew the B-52, the FB-111, and the B-1. I mean, he's had a great career, done a lot of great things. You know, a couple years ago, probably by now, Mike collaborated with some other folks on a book, Managing U.S. Nuclear Operations in the 21st Century, which came out from Brookings Institute Press. And Mike wrote Chapter 5, which was called Turning Presidential Guidance into Nuclear Operations Plans. And Mike, welcome to NucleCast. I almost forgot to say that. So welcome into the podcast.
Thank you.
So you wrote this chapter, and, you know, I read your chapter because I was prepping a set of slides to walk some engineers through how we do nuclear planning and, you know, what that process looked like. And your, you know, unclassified description was the best description I've seen of that process. And you really had a really nice graphic, and I stole your graphic. Fortunately, you sent it to me and I put it on a slide. And, you know, it's an 8-step planning process that I walk people through whenever I talk about it. And so what I thought is, who better than the guy who is probably one of the most experienced guys around to actually do all that nuclear planning, and then who wrote built the great slide to begin with. Why not have that guy walk us through this planning process? So, Mike, let's talk about your chapter and let's talk about the planning process for nuclear targeting.
Sure. And first, thanks for having me. The process, if you lay it out in a linear fashion like this, looks pretty straightforward, 8 simple steps. Having said that, there are all kinds of things going on that aren't on the book that go much deeper into the process. But these are the essential 8 steps, if you will. And after a period of mission analysis, which means analyzing the guidance, the planning guidance given to the planners and to the commander of STRATCOM, they come up with a series of military objectives that they're required to achieve and potential courses of action to do that. When they have that in hand, they establish what's called a joint target coordination board. And joint's the important word in that sentence, is that it includes functional experts from within each of the service components for STRATCOM, as well as the appropriate regional combatant commanders, and then a lot of experts from around, functional experts from the intelligence community, which there are many, many different organizations managing that. Each one of these functional experts is given an opportunity to nominate targets that they believe will help accomplish the mission objectives, the military objectives, that is, and then achieve success in each one of these various courses of action. And in a plan like STRATCOM develops, there's going to be a lot of different courses of action in there, from small plans to very large comprehensive plans. It's no longer the day of the single integrated operational plan where you have one big plan and 4 or 5 big options within that. These are very discrete options. And the other issue is that it's no longer just a bipolar world. We have many nuclear-armed potential adversaries out there that we have to prepare for. When the JTCB finishes their work, they produce what's called a joint integrated prioritized targeting list. It sounds like it's a big piece of paper. In fact, it's a big digital file. I mean, this is all computer-aided planning these days. And that becomes the basis for StratCom to go internal, largely internal at that point, where they're developing the aim points for those plans. Those are called a desired ground zero. And what that is a specific point on the surface, theoretically below the surface of the earth from an embedded weapon, and then, or more likely, above the surface of the earth, where they expect if you detonate a nuclear weapon, it'll achieve the specified level of damage, whatever that happens to be for the particular target. This is similar to talking about functional kill or K-kill in the conventional world, but it's really about measuring either moderate or severe damage to the structures that are in those different facilities out there. When they complete that, they have an aim point for each one of the facilities, and I should add that it could be one facility for each aim point, or it could be multiple facilities in a closely packed area for each aim point. But that will lead to what's called a national DGZ list, or NDL. That's available within the planning system to all the planners, and it's identified by what specific course of action it's intended for. And these aim points could be in multiple courses of action, depending on what the requirement is, from a very small discrete course of action to a much larger one. Exactly the same aim point could be used in each one of those. What's important in that DGZ is there's geographic coordinates, of course, and those are generic for any, you know, where the aim point is generic for any weapon system. But they also generate a height of burst that's specific to each delivery system. So for a gravity bomb, obviously, it's going to be a surface burst. But for an ICBM or SLBM or cruise missile, it could be a different height of burst. What the objective is when they build these is, of course, to achieve the specified level of damage as a first priority. But then they also try to minimize collateral damage to structures around them to the extent possible, which is why in some cases the aim point could be offset from multiple facilities and use fewer weapons that way to achieve the same objective. Now, once the DGZs or this family of DGZs is created, then they turn it over to a team whose job is to assign weapon system types, not a specific sortie level, if you will, but a weapon system type that could be based in part on the guidance they are given that they want a rapidly arriving weapon. Well, that would be an ICBM being the most rapid, or if they wanted to avoid overflight of particular areas, they wanted to have a particular yield to make it a small option. They make judgments based on what that guidance is right now, and they add a code to the course of action identifier for each DGZ of what type of weapon you're supposed to put on this. In some cases, planners could be given guidance to create multiple different options for them or courses of action with each weapon system. So you could have one course of action, meaning one particular DGZ or a small family of DGZs with an ICBM specific option, an SLBM option, or a bomber delivered option. And what they would look for in that is meaningful differences between the two. You could be trading off how rapidly a weapon would arrive there for different levels of damage, and that gives policymakers choices. As you can guess, there are few perfect choices in doing any building plans like this, and there some of those trade spaces would be dependent on the world's situation at the time. So that's when they do that. When the allocation is complete, they then pass it off to what I'll call the strike planners. These are folks who are qualified in each one of the three different weapon systems, or more if there's more weapon systems out there, so that they can build detailed routes of flight or flight profiles for ballistic missiles for each individual option, however many there are. So in the case of bombers, They would develop a specific route of flight from their planned takeoff base through either the cruise missile launch point or the target, in the case of a gravity weapon, and then onto a post-strike base. In the case of ICBMs or SLBMs, they would plan it from its predicted launch point, ICBM a fixed site, through to the target. In the case of the SLBMs, a little more challenging because the submarines, ballistic missile submarines, have a specified patrol area, which is fairly significant to improve the survivability of the submarines. So when they do their plans, they have to provide a profile that was achievable from anywhere within that patrol area, which takes a little more computer time to do that. But when they're done, the planners are assured that they will have that ability to strike the targets. That file, when it's completed, and again, it's discrete options from small to big that are all built coherently one to the other. When that force application is done, if it's an option where there's more than one weapon in it, which is probably predictable, then they have to make sure that they're timed so that one weapon doesn't destroy another arriving weapon, and that is called timing and deconfliction. And deconfliction being the operative word there. Timing is a method of doing that. So in the case of an ICBM or SLBM, when the launch authorization is granted, some people, I suppose, have an image of them all coming off out of their launch tubes at the same time. In fact, they can adjust the timing on the launch sequence on those based on their location and everything to make sure that there isn't a conflict of the arrival of the weapons. A little easier with the bombers because of the big time separation in an option where there were all three type of weapon systems in there. But even within the bomber sorties or cruise missiles, for example, they have to make sure that those are separated in time. The temporal separation is what gives you the deconfliction on it. When the sorties are all timed, once again, this is a digital file that's then passed on to a group that analyzes each one of the options and makes an evaluation of completeness for it, make sure that there's not any errors. They have specific programs that will check this, and then the human eye on it. The important thing is here is they're going to generate estimates of damage for each one of the options in damage in terms of achieving the objectives. They'll make a subjective judgment about it either achieves the mission requirements or not. Objective measures are fine for it, and that's just going to give you a number, a probability, if you will, of achieving that specified level of damage. But it's really the subjective judgment of whether this is good enough, overkill, or not good enough. And then the other thing they do through this is they generate reports that estimate what the consequences of execution would be for each one of these options. That means what kind of fatalities or casualties you could expect in it. And there's an opportunity in there to adjust plans to positively influence that. Now, that's one of the things I'll add in right now is it's easy looking at a chart like this to portray it as just a linear process. Sure. It, in fact, is not just a linear process. There's a lot of times you'll return to the previous step to make adjustments to it. And in the greater process, even with the policy, that interaction could change what the stated requirements are for it in light of new information that's available to the planners. the last thing they look out there is quality assessment, which is, first of all, the quality checks on it are both a computer-aided integral part at each planning step. There's error checks that it runs on that. And then the bigger quality check at the end of the system. Another important feature is that at some point in the plan, and I'll be vague on that, they implemented what I would call a two-person process. And what that's designed to do is to guarantee the integrity of the files out there. So one person doing a step and another person observing that process. to make sure that everything that goes in is what they want to go in, and everything that comes out is what was intended. So that's a pretty key part from the guaranteeing the integrity of the plan. Now, the last step in this is the old story about the mission's not done until the paperwork's complete. Well, that's exactly what we have to do here. With the possible exception, it's not really paperwork anymore. It's digital files. That's not to say that some of this doesn't get turned into hard copies, but sure. These are weapon system specific digital incarnations of what the plans are supposed to be, and those are transmitted via secure means to each one of the specific units. And then equally as important to each one of the worldwide command and control elements that is out there. And there, as I said, they're tailored specifically to the weapon system. So it could be a magnetic disc pack that goes out, or it could be literally transmitted over secure wires. In the bomber community, of course, you're going to have more paper associated with the visualization of charts. And routes of flight and stuff like that. But in the end, when those are transmitted out, then and only then are you able to do that. So I will pause for a breath there.
Well, thanks for that explanation. It's one I don't think many people ever get an opportunity to hear. So we're now at that time of the show where I have to take a quick break. But when we get back, I want you to delve into the other commands and elements that contribute to this entire process, because it's not just STRATCOM. It's lots of folks who are doing discrete functions that help make this possible. So when we get back, just give us sort of a rundown of who those players are and what they do. You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
Join the ANWA Deterrence Center team and exchange monitor at the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, January 27th through 29th at the Crystal Gateway Marriott. This year's summit features speakers from NNSA, U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, National Laboratories, the U.S. Department of Energy, Department of Defense, contractors, and more. Sign up through the link on our website to receive a 15% ANWA Deterrence Center discount at anwadeter.org. We hope to see you there.
And we're back, and we're talking to Mike Elliott. Mike, you gave a great description of how that 8-step process for nuclear planning works. So who else contributes to each of those various steps?
Well, I almost hate to use this, but that old adage of it takes a village. It really is a community effort here. And when I say community, the nuclear enterprise, there are a lot of different people. It starts with the policy. And if you've had an opportunity to be involved in the gestation of a new policy document as a new administration comes in, it's pretty impressive the intensity of the dialogue and the number of people who have a voice in that discussion. Now, I would emphasize that while every new administration comes in thinking they're making enormous changes to the policy and everything like that, the reality over the 70 or so years of doing this is the changes are pretty incremental. The basic facts of trying to deter an adversary or how you would prosecute a war don't change unless some of the things like the weapon system types changes or stuff like that. So the clarity given in guidance makes everything that happens after that. So there's a very collaborative effort with the military, providing advice to the policymakers. And there's a debate within the policy community about, you know, an example of no first use is debated every 4 years for certain. And, you know, you could do an entire show on the policy evolution of this also. But the military's job in that process is to advise them of what are the implications of various policies, what would our capability be to achieve these, et cetera, or is there new capabilities if you want to have a particular policy. The second big community piece in this is the regional combatant commanders. I mean, there's no place in the world right now that isn't in some commander's area of responsibility. And so when STRATCOM, a global and functional combatant right. command is working on this. They need to involve that regional combatant commander. And this is very different than the single integrated operational plan, PSYOP days, where it was kept under a very close hat and not even people in the regionals had much input to what was going on. Today, it's very much a collaborative effort between that, those combatant commands and the planners in Omaha. It goes without saying that the work that the intelligence community is doing every day and goes on for year after year after year in understanding facilities and potential threats to the United States or its allies or friends is an important piece of this. That database that they produce underlies everything that the planners do after that. And then I should give a shout out to the combat support agencies that do all kinds of things largely in the shadows that help do it. DGRA is an easy example for me because they build, maintain most of the effects type modeling that's done out there. So when they calculate damage, it's using tools that are provided by DGRA. When they look at the consequences of execution, they're using tools that are developed and then maintained by DTRA largely.
You know, you mentioned DTRA. And so I would just give a shout out to, for those in the audience who are, you know, either Air Force or Army civil servants or active duty or Navy or whoever else that can go to the Defense Nuclear Weapons School that's out at Kirtland Air Force Base, because they have, you know, they have a couple of great courses, and, you know, that's where I learned nuclear targeting was through their courses. And they've got some great instructors that'll teach you how to run that software that DTRA is responsible for that you're talking about. And I'll never forget whenever I started learning targeting and weapons effects, it really opens up your eyes to exactly, you know, what you can and can't do with weapons and what the effects were and how you can shape effects. That was really what I thought was sort of eye-opening for me, was the ability to shape effects. And you learn that, you know, when you start working on targeting like you're talking about.
Sure. And they will burst the bubble on a lot of misconceptions about them too, which I think is an important part of it.
Yeah, sorry for that interruption, but I just had to throw that. If for those who don't know about DNWS, look it up and look at their courses.
Yeah, I agree. It's a good course.
All right, so go ahead. So DTRA has these great courses. Who is there other agencies that are helping
sure.
us?
Sure. I mean, Defense Intelligence Agency, obviously, with the important D in front of that, manages all of these inputs from the other intelligence services. From functional experts around the world and everything. DIA there is therefore responsible for putting that information and maintaining the database from which all of this information is derived for the planners. And that's a 24/7, 365, decade after decade task. And you, the plan can't be any better than the information they put in there. And so that's critically important. A mistake at that can have ugly consequences down the road.
Yeah. And all that information they're throwing in there for people that don't know, you know, all that weather information, geography, the VNTK scores that goes into that DTRA software that we're talking about. I mean, that's just invaluable information to help you understand. So like you mentioned, if you want to limit and better understand casualties, because you have all that information, you can then shape those effects to do exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is that, of course, this is all highly classified information at various levels, and that keeps it in the shadows somewhat. But
yeah.
The National Security Agency, if you want to protect that data, the requirements for encryption, for helping develop code books that can protect the execution process, those are important pieces that, understandably, they don't talk about a lot out there. The geospatial information, like sometime after 1988, they were just developing a good digitized terrain elevation for the weapon system. For the modern weapon systems, it really had that. And so with DTED data, you can do a wonderful job in understanding the flight profile of a cruise missile, for example, as opposed to having to plan that weapon system higher to avoid terrain impact and stuff like that. That gives them the capability to have weapon systems hugging the nap of the earth, if you will, and having stuff like that. And a common coordinate system with sufficient refinement for the very, very modern weapons we have today.
Yeah. So we are getting to that point in the show where I would like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, of course, Bob grants all guests 3 wishes that, but they have to be related to, the topics we've been discussing. No wishing you were back in the 111 or any of that. It's only what we can change here in the future. So, Mike, let me ask you, what is your first wish?
Well, you ruled out the going back in time to fly the airplanes. You didn't rule out giving me an opportunity to fly in a shiny new B-21. So,
you and me both.
And I would like the opportunity to prove to all the young pups out there that I still got it.
I don't know about you, but my knees are hurting these days, and lifting
not
weights.
Required. Number two, I'll get more serious on it, and I will wish that the Congress of the United States has the wisdom and the conviction to carry through the plan of record on recapitalization of our nuclear forces, because there's not a time I can think of in my lifetime that it's been more important to get it done and get it done now with the world situation being what it is.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's hope that, and let's hope it probably expands, because even Biden administration folks, Vipin Narang and Pranay have all said that, we're probably going to have to expand, not just, build new, but expand. And that, for a administration that came in wanting to reduce, that sort of 180 degree turn is pretty significant. So it clearly, tells us that the world is far more dangerous than anticipated.
I completely agree with that. I having lived through the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact and a period in which everyone was taking the peace dividend, cutting back nuclear stuff and everything. Now, 30 some years later, we're reversing course, not because anybody particularly wants to, in our military or government, but we're going to be forced to do it because of what's out there. So completely agree with that.
Okay, so we got one more wish.
And I'm going to have to break your rules and and not make it on subject, but go Lions, win the Super Bowl.
it's funny you say go Lions, because Kim is a Michigander, and she's a big fan, our producer, of the Lions. And so for me as a Chiefs fan, I'm looking forward to the Chiefs beating the Lions in the Super Bowl.
Happy to meet you there.
Well, now, as we end the show, we've got a couple minutes left. And for those who don't know much about nuclear targeting and the process and the effort, there's a lot of misconceptions, right? I can't tell you how many people talk about accidental launch and all of these things that are just like, I just had to shake my head and just say, man, if you understood how we do what we do and what it takes, how much is left of launch, you wouldn't think that those sort of misconceptions are all that possible. So can you maybe for the last minute or so just give our listeners sort of your elevator pitch, your walking away message, so that they really understand this whole process and just what it means and what we put into it?
Sure. And I'm completely with you on that. It makes me cringe when I hear unintended, unauthorized, accidental launches out there, or the entire system. And we live in a world in today where infantrymen are getting specific guidance about whether they can take the shot with somebody in their ear in the process. Well, the nuclear community takes this to the nth degree. There are two people involved in absolutely every decision that's made on at every stop in that process. So in the cockpit, in the command centers, special authorization codes to make sure that you've got the president on the line. Every step in this process is intended to prevent any kind of unauthorized launch out there, accidental launch, if you will. So I'm confident that given the quality of the people we have and the specific system that we have out there, that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and it's also important for people to understand that it's not a system built for a president who gets angry one day and says, I'm going to get even, we're going to nuke those SOBs. It just doesn't work that way.
No, not at all. And the president's surrounded by advisors who are, some of whom would be in the middle of the night, if you will, the 2 a.m. in the middle of the night, are going to be on that call. Everyone in the system, from the president down, understands the legal requirements for use of force. And once again, I have pretty high confidence in the system operating as it's intended in there.
All right. Mike Elliott, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, the listeners. Hopefully you found this episode great. It's the first time we've talked about nuclear targeting in that process. So thanks for being with us, and we'll see you on the next episode. I don't think anybody knows as much about nuclear planning as Mike Elliott. I mean, he's had literally every job you can have for a nuclear planner. So it was great to have him come and talk. You know, it's a topic we've never talked about, and it's a topic that most people don't ever get a chance to hear about. So hopefully you enjoyed it and found it informative, because I thought it was a great discussion.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.